Good evening. This is the colleague. We have new microphones. This is the Health Commission meeting of November 2007. Welcome, everyone. First order of business are the minutes of last month's meeting. Are there any corrections or additions to those minutes as they were sent out to us? There being no corrections or additions, I'll look for a motion for acceptance. Moved and seconded. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, the minutes are approved as mailed out. Next order of business is public comment. Anybody wanting to speak on an issue that is not on our agenda may come forward, and you have 3 minutes. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Enns. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. And I'm here to once more ask the Commission to endorse labeling of genetically engineered food. And there are several reasons for that. One would be to do it for Dr. Thomas, who, as you all will recall, at the supervisors' meeting in the summer of 2006, when genetic engineering was on the supervisors' agenda, Dr. Thomas came out clearly in favor of labeling. Since then, we've had a good example locally. The Avila Valley Barn is labeling a genetically engineered food, and the sky has not fallen. And those of you who read the paper will also know that the Tribune endorsed editorially what has been done. Other countries do this routinely. As far as we know, this is the first time in California and probably the nation where a food product has been labeled as being genetically engineered so the public will know. Let's be part of history and get with it and support labeling. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Is there anyone else? No. All right. That closes the public comment period, and now we will move on to the to our program on family violence, and Commissioner Shimousis will introduce our speakers.
Good evening. I'd like to welcome you all and thank you for coming to the Commission. I think Karen Coffey from Victim Witness will be doing an introduction on the actual panel members. What I would like to say, and I will also speak as a volunteer at the end of the panel presentation, is that as an intro to family violence and domestic violence per se, I was just speaking with one of our other commissioners and noted that it's no more or less pervasive today than it has been since I first started volunteering about 13 years ago. I think the big difference that I've seen is not only our ability but our willingness to talk about it and to move towards solutions and prevention that I never saw before. So I applaud the efforts of these folks and of my fellow volunteers and of the Commission for allowing and even inviting a very difficult topic to deal with. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening, and thank you so much for having us all here. And I'm going to try to get used to the camera. This is new for me, so I'm going to be like those kids. I'm like, oh, there I am. Anyway, okay, I digress. Anyway, thank you so much for having us here tonight and let us speak to this very important issue. My name is Karen Coffey, and I'm the Assistant Director of the District Attorney's Victim Witness Assistance Center for the County of San Luis Obispo. And Pam Hetherington very graciously asked us to come forward and speak to your commission on these issues. She is a member of our Domestic Violence Task Force, and we thank you for having us here. Family violence has many forms, and to do any of these issues justice would really take much more than the hour and a half that we have here tonight. So what we hope to do with this panel is give you folks a brief snapshot of the problems surrounding violence in our homes, in our communities, and services for these families, and how our county is able to respond to the issue. And hopefully by the end of the panel, you will have gained enough information on how well we are dealing with this problem in our county and the services available to victims of violence. The following topics are going to be briefly reviewed. Domestic violence is going to be referred to, I had to narrow the scope. Domestic violence is such a large word. And when we think of domestic violence, we're immediately thinking of boyfriends, girlfriends, husbands, and wives. Well, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta has actually coined the term intimate partner violence, and that's what we're going to be focusing on when we think of domestic violence. And Beth Robb from the San Luis Obispo Women's Shelter is going to be speaking to you about intimate partner violence and the services they offer. From there, we're going to go to Dana Hansen, who's here from our Adult Protective Services Agency, and he's going to be addressing elder abuse and dependent adult abuse. And then we have Elise Roberts from the Department of Social Services Child Welfare Division, and she can speak to how their agency handles child abuse cases in their families. And I was starting to add up the years among the four of us here, and it's really a lot. Been doing this a long time. So we must like what we're doing. And then to round out the panel, we're going to be hearing briefly from Penny Shimousis as a survivor who's going to be giving us a personal perspective on the issue. So I'd like to start first with my agency. I am, as I said, I've been 20 years with the District Attorney's Victim Witness Assistance Center. Most people, unless they're a crime victim, don't understand what our agency is or does. I'll briefly explain. Victim Witness Centers have been a part of our state for 30 years now. We just celebrated our 30th anniversary. We're the second oldest Victim Witness Center in the state. And basically, our mission is to provide comprehensive assistance to victims of crime and their families, to coordinate witness appearances in court, and to reduce the trauma, frustration, and inconvenience experienced by crime victims and witnesses. We want to make sure that victims know what their rights are statutorily, and we have quite a few rights that are available to victims, and it is our job as advocates to let them know. We do have a special, we have advocates in all of our courtrooms. We have a special unit that deals strictly with elder abuse, and then we have witness coordination. The services basically that we provide to victims and witnesses are crisis intervention. Most of our phone calls do come to us from law enforcement. Continuing contact with victims. We want to make sure that they understand the criminal justice system, what's happening with their cases, what charges will be filed or not filed, what's the difference between a felony and a misdemeanor, all of those things. We do field visits to victims' homes or offices or other locations. As the assistant director, I do respond to crime scenes. We respond, unfortunately, to homicide crime scenes and work very intensely on those cases when they do occur. We have special services for our elder and dependent adult victims. We have a special advocate now assigned just for juvenile crimes. That's become quite a large part of the crimes coming in the office. We have Cal Poly interns that now work with all of, or exclusively with all our property crime victims. We do provide emergency assistance. We have a special fund in our office that comes to us through donations from the community where we can provide emergency food, clothing, and shelter. For instance, if the women's shelter is completely full and we must place somebody, we have a hotel downtown where we can place someone. We can get food certificates if they're not able to either make the rent or buy the food. We can help them with those types of services. And, of course, we work very, very closely with all of our agencies. We make referrals on a daily basis to Child Welfare Services, Adult Protective Services, both our women's shelters. We work very closely with probation and law enforcement. And then it's our job to make sure that the crime victim is linked with the district attorney, the prosecutor that is handling their case, so that they have a clear understanding of what can happen, what the possible outcomes are. That's very, very brief. I actually could spend probably an hour or two more explaining in depth what our services are, but I think that kind of gives you a good outline of how we function here in the district attorney's office. Beth Robb is going to go next with from the San Luis Obispo Women's Shelter on intimate partner violence.
Thank you, Karen. And thank you for having us here tonight to talk about this issue. I'm from the Women's Shelter Program of San Luis Obispo, and we deal with intimate partner violence. And what that means is if there's an intimate partner relationship, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a husband, a wife, same-sex couples, if there's violence in that relationship, they can come to us for services. And there's actually two women's shelters. We have the Women's Shelter of San Luis Obispo County, and we kind of work San Luis Obispo in South County. And then there's the North County Women's Resource Center and Shelter, who's kind of divided by the grade. They are up in Paso, Atascadero, and that area. But we work back and forth with each other. So if they had a room and we had a victim, we would trade back and forth, and we sit on the task force with them and everything. So we do work closely, and they have a lot of the same services we do. It's just difficult sometimes for victims to try to get all the way down to grade to get services. So it's provided in both areas. It's not really isolated to just female victims. I think one of the concepts in our society is that all victims of intimate partner violence are female. However, we are seeing an increase in male victims also, and women can be just as violent and deadly, really, as a male batterer can. But we do still see primarily female victims. About 85% is still female victims. And then we also have services for the children, because when they come in, you know, the women or the men can bring their children for safety. And it used to be women would come in and the children just kind of got to pick up the morsels that dropped behind to help them out. And so what we're trying to do is really provide a children's program where they can come in and they can get counseling, 17 and under, absolutely free. And then we, of course, have a child advocate that works on different case management things that the children might need in that situation. Domestic violence also includes many different types of violence. It's not just the physical. A lot of people think, oh, well, it's the black eye or it's the broken arm or something like that. Well, that's kind of, domestic violence has been going on in that couple's relationship for quite a while when it hits the physical point. There's also sexual abuse that can go on in domestic violence or intimate partner violence situation. There's verbal abuse. And emotional abuse. Emotional abuse is always involved in an intimate partner violence relationship. And when we ask our victims who call us what was the most damaging, a lot of times it's the emotional, the verbal, the neglect that happens in an intimate partner relationship. Intimidation, isolation of the victim. Lots of times victims are isolated from family, from friends, from coworkers. Maybe they're not allowed to work, and they have to stay home. And it's a very gradual process, but it's that part of the power and control in the situation. Because intimate partner violence isn't about anger issues, it isn't about, you know, mental illness. What it is, it's a power and control situation over another person. And they're using that power control, and one of the great ways to use power and control over another person is isolation. Economic abuse is really big, because in our society, who controls the money controls the situation. They control the relationship. So, and any time there are children in the house, if there is intimate partner violence, then there is child abuse. It is legally child abuse, and they do need services. And part of the code, the penal code that we have in California, is that all medical personnel are actually mandated to report intimate partner violence to law enforcement. And that penal code is 11160. And it's any health practitioner employed in a health facility, clinic, physician's office, local or state public health department, or a clinic or other type of facility operated by a local or state public health department. And it goes on. I mean, the whole code is quite long, so I won't read the whole thing. But if somebody comes in and they have signs of intimate partner violence, then that person, the nurse, the ER doctor, their general practitioner, their OBGYN, whoever it is, the X-ray technician, they're all supposed to report to law enforcement. Some of the resources we have that the medical personnel can use and utilize is our 24-hour crisis hotline. They can call the 549-8989 number, and that's the hotline for the county. They can get a hold of us or the North County Shelter 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and they can access either the safe house if that's what the person needs, or they can have just resources. Maybe the person comes in, but they're not ready to leave the relationship. They can still talk to a trained 40-hour volunteer or staff member about resources that is out there and what the victim can do, what they want to do. So if, say, somebody came into the emergency room and a nurse was there and she said, okay, this is intimate partner violence. What she could do is give that person a safe place in that hospital where they could talk to us on the phone. And so that person, that victim, could process what has happened and talk to a trained person about what resources are available so that that victim can then make the decision on what they want to do. And then they have that information, and it gives them a sense of power and control over a situation that they haven't had much power or control in. Another thing we have is this confidential safe house. The confidential safe house is female-based. However, it is, you know, if a man calls us and he's in a situation, we have safety procedures that we can do to keep a male and his children safe. So for a safe house, a female can come in with all of her kids, you know, 5 kids, 2 kids, whatever it is. For teenagers, we do assess the teenagers before we bring them in to make sure that they are safe for the other members of the house. Sometimes teenagers will identify with the batterer or something like that, so we will safety plan around that. So they can come in to the safe house. It is absolutely free. We have food. We can get clothes, legal help. It's all right there, counseling on site. The stay is about 8 weeks, give or take. That's an average, some a little less, some a little more. We also have counseling in 2 sites. We have counseling here in San Luis and down in South County, and we have counselors that go into the schools also. And then we have a legal clinic that helps with temporary restraining orders, court advocacy, court accompaniment. Many times when a person goes to court to try to get a restraining order, that may be the first time they've seen a person who has been abusing them. And so we try to provide that emotional support, somebody who is there with them and can walk them through the system. And that's where we work with victim witness a lot too and refer back to them. And they help us out with those courts. And then we also have a transitional apartment complex. It's a 6-unit place where a person can come into our system, and it's very hard to get housing in San Luis Obispo County. It can be very expensive. And so if they're low income and an intimate partner violence victim, they can move from either the safe house or the counseling program or the legal clinic and move into that transitional house. It's just they pay rent. We work with them on it. They still get case management and counseling, but it is their apartment. Their mom can come see them. Their sister can come see them. It's their place. They come and go as they please. So one of the big questions we do get asked is, how can I help? You know, and if you're in this situation, I think one of the most important things is just to believe the person, to believe that this can happen in our society, and this is real and it's pervasive. And it's wonderful now, as Penny said, that we can talk about it and there's awareness. So, and giving them our number and giving them the information to get the resources. Many times they will say, well, you know, I'll give it to her, but she won't do anything with it. Well, I picked up a woman one night who had carried our card around for 4 months before she called. She'd got it from law enforcement. So it's a seed. You're planting a seed when you talk to somebody, when you're brave enough to say, here's some information that may help you. And so I think that's all my time. I think I talked the whole time.
That's okay.
So thank you very much. I'll pass it on.
Okay. Thanks. We're going to pass it on to Dana Hansen now from Adult Protective Services.
Thank you, Karen. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. Thank you for inviting us. And I must say, I work Adult Protective Services now, but prior to working APS, I worked Child Welfare Services. And we worked hand in hand, well, victim witness and the women's shelter. And they're a great partner, both great partners to have in our community. They've done wonders with a lot of our folks that we've worked with. So, but getting back to APS, what I'd just say, kind of in a nutshell, what we have in our unit, we have 5 full-time employees and 1 part-time, 1 half-time employee. On the average, we receive roughly 100, 120 referrals a month. And that ranges from financial abuse, neglect, both neglect by others, self-neglect, isolation, physical abuse, emotional abuse. Of all those, we're probably seeing more fiduciary abuse. And I think the reason for that is as the first of the year, savings, banks, they became mandated reporters. So we're receiving more referrals from financial institutions, and we've been giving a lot of talks to them and explaining our procedures, what to look for, although most banks are pretty good at what they observe on that, and they report to us, and we're able to investigate it from there. And then what we do is if we suspect there's a crime, of course we get, we'll notify law enforcement. And so law enforcement will do their piece in that. We do our piece. Unfortunately, with a lot of our elders, where the abuse is being the perpetrator's family member, they don't want to prosecute. It's documented by us, by law enforcement, but the individual is usually going to commit another crime. If it's not a family member, a lot of times we're seeing folks that have befriended the elder, and they've moved in. Before you know it, they're taking money, their cars, sometimes their homes. A quick claim, quick deed, and you know the home is theirs. But by it being brought to our attention, we're able to hopefully rectify some of that by whether or not law enforcement's involved, making referrals. Might be an attorney that deals with conservatorships, getting that into probate court and having that reversed, and hopefully get their home back in their name. But we handle a wide variety of referrals, different types of situations, and a lot of it is focused on domestic violence. Doesn't matter, 16, 18, 28, 88, domestic violence is out there. And I think we're seeing more referrals focused on domestic violence. And like Beth said, it doesn't matter. Not always is it the female that's the perpetrator. The majority of the time, reverse that, where the male's the perpetrator, the female is as well. But for the majority of the time, it's the male that's the aggressor in a lot of these. A lot of isolation. They've been in a situation for years, sometimes married 50-plus years, and they're very fearful. What am I going to do now? You know, they're a lot of times they'll just live in that type of situation, just live the rest of their days in that type of situation, even though they're not happy and they're miserable a lot of times. But, you know, they don't know where they're going to go. So we have the Women's Resource Center to piggyback on and to go forward, and a lot of times we'll staff things and see what we can do. And if there's crimes involved, we're with the DA's office here. So we are seeing a lot with our elders that are being abused, and not just verbal abuse. Sometimes some pretty ugly, aggressive type physical assaults that we're seeing. Some of that goes hand in hand with the dementia or Alzheimer's. Individuals may have been a little grumpy in their earlier years, but now if they have onsets of dementia or Alzheimer's, it may become very aggressive. And some of the women we see, some of the elders, are very, very fearful of being in those type of situations. So we all put our heads together in this county. I must say, coming from a larger county in Southern California, where you might be lost in all the community partners that are available here in this county. It's a tight-knit community, and our resources are here, and everybody's willing to step in and lend a hand. So I.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go to Elise Roberts now with Child Welfare Services. Okay.
Thank you for having us. And I am, as mentioned, I'm Elise Roberts. I'm currently a regional manager in our Napomo office. But before that, I spent approximately 13 years as a child welfare social worker and a child welfare services supervisor. and I saw quite a bit of domestic violence on my caseload. One reason for that was because I spent 5 years at the San Luis Obispo Women's Shelter, so they felt I could handle those cases as they came in through our system. I think that it's important to recognize by the variety of agencies you have sitting at the table today that intimate partner violence, domestic violence, family violence, whatever term you use, it takes every agency at this table and more to really address the problem. It's not an issue that can be compartmentalized and fixed over here and just go away. So I commend you for bringing all of this here to the table today, because it does take all of us in our various aspects to address this issue. I'd like to give you a few statistics, what we see in our department, Child Welfare Services, and then talk about the different services we have to offer. As I mentioned, child abuse is a form of family violence that has lasting consequences for children and their families. Under our guidelines, we define child abuse, we define family violence as emotional abuse of children. So that is how it comes into our system in child welfare. And we see it cut across all ethnic groups and all socioeconomic groups. On average, the San Luis Obispo Department of Social Services receives approximately 289 calls of suspected child abuse or neglect every month. And of those calls, approximately 209 receive some sort of response. Of that 209, 11% of those calls are responded to by a community partner, typically the Economic Opportunity Commission, who we work with very closely. But the other 89% are given a face-to-face response by a child welfare social worker. There are approximately 352 children in San Luis Obispo County in foster care at this time. 63% of those children have drug and alcohol issues as a part of the concerns that brought them to our attention in our department. Of that 352, 41% of that drug and alcohol abuse is meth. 24% of these children will have some sort of family mental health issue or issues in their family, and 19% will have identified domestic violence as a critical issue in their family when they come to our attention. We have another 210 children receiving services in their family setting at this time. While domestic violence at 19% seems to be a rather low number, what that statistic tells us is that is just addressing the concern in the present. That tells us nothing about the families that we see every day that have had domestic violence in the past and have gotten away, but there continues to be long-lasting effects to the children and the family members as a result of that parent taking that very bold and brave step to remove themselves from a very dangerous situation. One of the lasting effects that we are now seeing is the intergenerational domestic violence and family violence that we see among our youth population, our teenagers that come into our system in child welfare. The violence that we are seeing with these young people is increasing, and as Beth mentioned before, we are seeing a huge increase in the teenage girls becoming violent towards their friends, their partners, their younger siblings, their mothers, their fathers. And so many of these teenagers not only cross the child welfare system, but they become a part of the juvenile services system as well. And they also comprise a large part of our group home population. And at this time, we have approximately 210 children that no longer are eligible for reunification services with their parents, meaning that they are in some sort of situation where it is unlikely that they are going to go home to their children, and that is out of that 352 number that I mentioned before. About 100 of those 210 children are in an active adoption or guardianship process, but that still leaves another 110, typically teenagers, that have no permanent connection to an adult, and we are striving very hard to find them a permanent connection with some adult in their lives that can create stability when they leave the system. As we know, the foster care statistics for children aging out at 18 is pretty dismal. Only about 25% graduate from high school, and what we see across the nation is approximately 40% of the prison population has been in foster care at one time or another. Many of those children aging out of foster care at age 18 have no place to go, and they also comprise our homeless population. So we are striving very hard with the help of all these agencies at this table and many more in the community to really look at the resources for these children, because as we know, most young people are not ready at age 18 to be on their own, and their only options are to live on the street, go from couch to couch to couch, or go back to the family that abused or neglected them. With that said, we have a variety of options that we can offer to a family through the child welfare system. We have two primary levels of response when we receive a referral. We have an immediate response, which is by statute within 24 hours, although we try very often to get out there within 2 to 3 hours to respond to that referral. Those are the highest level of referrals that we have. They typically involve sexual or physical abuse, and we typically take law enforcement with us because of the severity of the situation. We have another category called the 10-day response, and that's 10 calendar days for a social worker to make contact with a family to see if services or other issues can be addressed for that family. Those 10 days are typically neglect types of cases, lower level drug abuse cases, but not as severe as the sexual abuse, the physical abuse, or an active domestic violence call that we've just received from law enforcement. If it's determined that a family should receive services, we have both voluntary services and we have juvenile court intervention services. The voluntary services are really just non-court involved, and we're trying to work with the family without bringing them under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court. For children who are removed from their families, if any child in the family is under 3 at the time they are placed into foster care, the family is only entitled to about 6 months of reunification services. If all of the children are over age 3, then they are entitled by law to 12 months of reunification services. Those services can be increased to 18 months depending on the progress of the family and the parents on their case plans, their cooperation with other agencies, their behavioral changes so that they can provide a safer home for their children. But as you can imagine, 6, 12, or 18 months out of your home to try and reunify with your parents is a pretty difficult thing for any child to have to endure. So we take that very seriously and look at removing children only when it is absolutely necessary and there are no other options available. We also work with families with the children where they have not been removed because the risk issues and the safety issues are not as severe. Those cases are typically open for about a year or so, and we strive to achieve stability and safety for those children as well. But again, I can't stress enough that this is really a larger issue than just family violence or intimate partner violence in itself. All of these issues cross over one another and they all intersect. And the bottom line is we have children and families that are hurting, that don't have stability, they don't have housing, they don't have their basic needs met. And all of these issues, especially in a community like ours, where it is very difficult to find housing, stable employment, ways to meet your children's needs, increases the likelihood of these things happening to a child. So we also partner with our Employment Resource Division, our participant services, and we have instituted a program called Preventative Services where our CalWORKS eligibility staff work with families who are voluntarily choosing to do this to do preventative types of resources and referrals. So hopefully those families will never need to reach the child welfare system. So thank you.
Thank you. I think we were going to hear from, that was great, thank you. From Penny?
Thanks. Oh, thank you.
Sorry, new mics. Thanks for your presentation. I had so many thoughts going through my mind as I was listening to all of you as a volunteer. And interestingly, as Karen had mentioned, as a survivor, and I think we're all survivors. I don't know of anybody who isn't a survivor. Domestic violence, family violence has touched all of us as neighbors, as friends, as family members, maybe even as victims ourselves. And I think the thing that sticks in my mind over the years is of being a volunteer is it's when I'm talking to those people on the phone, sometimes very late at night, or even staying in the hospital, which I have stayed in the hospital many nights with women all night long. It's pretty scary to see the emergency room of a hospital locked down, too, in case any of you have never experienced that. It was one of the eeriest things I ever experienced. Hospitals locked down are just such an antithesis to me. I've been in healthcare all my life, but to see them locked down, that's pretty scary. But I still need to remind myself not to judge, to hear what that person is saying, to try to understand what it is they need from me and how I can help them, and to understand the courage that it took to make that phone call. And it does take a great deal of courage to get out of that situation. I can't explain that to people who haven't maybe been in it, but you know the evil that you're in, and you know how you can survive it. Sometimes you're so overwhelmed with being in that and dealing with it from day to day that it's difficult to see how you can survive otherwise. And what Beth does, and all of you actually do, to help women get out of that situation, particularly to afford people an alternate living opportunity. And I would like Beth to speak to some work opportunities too. But I don't know if you want to hear, I don't think you'd want to hear any graphic details of my experience as a volunteer, but I do it again. I've been in some scary situations, and sometimes it takes courage to be a volunteer too. And yes, I do it again, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be able to give back to women in that situation. So, I'd like to open it to the folks in the audience as well as the commissioners for questions. And I'd like to take prerogative, since I have Mike, to ask Beth, please, to talk about some work opportunities for the women in the particularly transitional housing situations.
Some work, you mean job opportunities, or how do we help them? Well, they're each assigned a case manager that comes in, and then what we do is they come in with different levels of job opportunities themselves, because intimate partner violence and indeed all of these, it doesn't know a socioeconomic bounds. It crosses all of them. So some of our women who come in may have, you know, engineering degrees. We've had a woman in there who was a manager of a bank branch, very high-powered job, and she was being horribly abused in her home. And so they come in with many different levels. So sometimes they come in and they have a job ready to go in place, but maybe they haven't worked in that field for a while. And so we can help them come into transitional where they can get on their feet. It's about an 18-month program. So they can have that stability to get on their feet. Some of them, though, come in with maybe no job education or no job opportunity around here, and they need to stay in the county. So they can go get, we hook them up with Shoreline Industries to do job training, or Questa or Poly, and different places like that to get education, maybe go into nursing or go into something else. Whatever really interests them is what we're aiming for. And then, of course, working with the kids and getting them back up where they need to be educationally, because a lot of times they can't focus in school. I mean, if you think about domestic violence happening in your home, how can you focus on your math test, you know? And so we'll work with the kids, getting them back into school and getting them working on their grades and extra help if they need it in different areas.
Are there any questions from the commissioners? Senator O'Dell.
Excuse me. Did you read that article in the Tribune today?
I didn't get to read it.
Well, it was an excellent article, I thought, about your, what you're talking about.
Oh, about what?
And they headed it, Father Not the Killer. And they were talking about people who were living together after, and the person, the man who was living with this woman ended up killing the child. And it was, I thought it was an excellent article that pointed out some of the problems.
Yeah.
You ought to read it.
Yeah, when I get through with my day. I have that still sitting on my desk.
Okay.
Commissioner Heatherton.
Dana, I learned something just recently. I think it was at the Domestic Violence Task Force, that a lot of the situations for the elder people as far as financial, sometimes the people that are overseeing their financial situations are convicted felons. Could you address that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, that's true, Pam. I heard a group that was at the probation parole department, excuse me, and an individual that worked there overheard several women talking that was waiting to see the parole officer, talking about how easy it was to get a job as an in-home caretaker. And it is. Very easily. There's usually no background criteria to get a job like that. There are several agencies in our county that provide those services. The majority of them, as far as I know, do some type of background screening for them. However, to what extent, I'm not sure. A lot of folks that do that type of work are transient. They move from place to place, and maybe if they have a record, say, in another part of the country, it may not, well, it wouldn't show up here if they're, the agency they're applying for was to do merely a local check on them. It's one of those occupations that people normally aren't breaking down the door to get into, very low paying. So it is hard to get qualified individuals to care for our elders. We have a thing, a program with the county of San Luis Obispo called In-Home Supportive Services. And that's a program that's focused primarily on very low-income individuals, to where we can get a provider in there to take care of certain needs. Some individuals need more services than others, depending on what their what type of injury or maybe some are paraplegic type individuals, so they'll need more than say somebody that's not. So and there's no cost to them for those type of services. We do a background check on the individuals for working with us. I've heard some horror stories, and I think we all have, of some of the elders just hiring somebody off the street. Word of mouth, they met somebody at a grocery store, and next thing you know, they're moving in, taking care of them, supposedly. You know, they're very trusting, and it's very easy to befriend an elder that's starving for attention. Maybe their kids don't, adult kids don't even come around to see them anymore. And all of a sudden, this man or this woman is their best friend. All of a sudden, they're moving in, and things start missing. Usually, they don't see the things that are missing up front. Usually, it's jewelry, you know, items that you don't typically, you know, look at on a daily basis. So it may be months before they notice something's missing. And by that time, maybe the caretaker's gone. So it's there. We, with our assessments, when we receive a referral and we go to an individual's home and meet with them, part of our assessment is trying to educate them on to safeguard themselves physically, financially, and we see it time and time again where somebody is calling them, trying to wiggle their way into their home. And they may not be a criminal. It may be somebody. I was at a woman's house last week, and just within the hour I was there, I think she had two telephone calls from banking institutions that wanted to do a reverse mortgage on her home. Magazine salespeople, you know, times they have stacks of magazines next to them that they have subscriptions on, but they don't read them, or most of them they don't. So there's a lot of people that are out trying to abuse our elder folks. So we try to educate them the best we can, but there's a lot of scams out there.
I think what Pam was referring to also in our task force meeting was the probation department mentioned that, was it 300?
300.
They in their research discovered that 300 of their probationers were doing in-home health care or services or assistance to seniors and dependent adults. So as an agency now, they're going out and checking on what kind of job they're doing, and if they, because they are mandated reporters, and this is something that they need to call APS and to do further investigation. So they've really gotten on top of this, I think, with at least their own probationer caseload, and they did bring it to the task force meeting. So,
in fact, Pam, on that, a couple of weeks ago, I gave a presentation to the probation department and was talking about these type of situations, and one of the probation officers mentioned that there are many of their caregivers that are working in the homes, and they were going to look into that closer and report to us if they suspect some type of abuse is going on.
I think one of the things that's happened in this county in the last year is all the adult, and I'm just now coming into this as starting to work with the adult community, but dependent adult and elder abuse community, but all of the councils got together and they wrote, and it took a long time, they wrote a protocol for first responders responding to elder and dependent adult abuse. We're in the process now in our office of developing a DVD and a PowerPoint. We're going to be training all of those, you know, fire, probation, law enforcement, ambulance, emergency rooms, banks. Who else is a first responder that I'm missing? They're going out to all of those agencies because we do have this special grant now we're working on to get the training to them. If we can't do the training, then they'll receive our DVD to use in their training. So I think we're going to really see a rise in the response to elder and dependent adult abuse, and that's a good thing because I think it's grossly underreported. We're sort of where we were with child abuse, I think, many years ago, where that's where we're going to go with elder abuse. And it's really been an exciting thing to watch. You're going to be very busy. Sure. Any other questions?
Yeah, I have another one. I guess this one will be directed toward Beth. When you cited the medical code of who has to report, does that include therapists as well? I know psychiatrists are medical doctors and are required, but are therapists?
Actually, I have a person in the audience I know can answer that for me. Benita, therapists are not mandated, right?
Could you come to the microphone, Benita, so that
this is Benita Zissa. She's contracted with us, and she was our clinical director for 18 years. 18 years.
She's also our expert witness in testifying on domestic violence issues in all our criminal trials for the district attorney's office.
Therapists, MFCCs, or clinical social workers, are only mandated reporters on intimate partner violence if they are working in a medical establishment. So if they're working at a hospital, which would more likely be a licensed clinical social worker, or they're working in some other medical situation, then they are mandated. Otherwise, they are not.
So private practice?
Private practice are not mandated. So that's an interesting piece of that.
Is that a situation that you feel should be changed?
No.
When the law was first written, they were included and wasn't working. So they changed it the next year, I believe. Correct, Benita? Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong. And they exempted therapists from the law in the settings that she spoke of. Okay. Are there any other questions?
Commissioner Warren?
Yes, I have one. Along those same lines, Beth, you talked about the all medical people being mandated. And then at the same time, do the medical people call you in from the shelter with the client, do you come in first? Because
no, they would report to law enforcement, and then law enforcement would take that from there. We would be called in on a voluntary basis. They could talk to the victim and say, would you like to talk to somebody from the shelter, and give them our information, and either they could talk to us right there, or that victim has the choice to take it with them and call us later. Yeah. But we can go to the hospital, as Penny has and I have before.
Okay. Another question was with the teenagers.
Yes.
What happens to them? Do you find them that alternate housing? And then what about the counseling situation for them?
The counseling, we do have in our counseling centers, we do see teens for teen dating violence. And we also have therapists who see them on site at different high schools, too, in around the county. Typically, we don't find them alternate housing. A lot of times with teen dating violence, sometimes they can stay in the home, or we would work with CWS, and CWS would take over the case, and we'd tag team with them for the housing. So what we provide for the teens are the counseling, case management, and working with CWS for those other things that we need with them.
Okay, because I was thinking of the teenager in a family. If you had a family unit come in and
right.
there was a teenager, that wouldn't be appropriate for the shelter.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So
right.
if they wouldn't be appropriate for the shelter, we would do safety planning around maybe there's a safe uncle or maybe there's a safe friend. Actually, when you have a teenage, particularly boy, even if he's safe to come in, he doesn't want to come to the women's shelter. You know, he's like, I am not going there, you know. I mean, it's just kind of the stigma. And a lot of times there is a safe friend or there is a safe neighbor who can keep them, and they can stay while the mom can come in with the other children and be safe. And that works with females, the female teens. We also assess them for the same reasons.
Okay, but then they're still kept in the loop of that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we absolutely keep them in. We'll bring them in for counseling. They may even do family counseling if that's what is deemed necessary by the counselor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
And then I had a question regarding the elder abuse for Dana. If an elder person was to call in regarding their caregiver, which is usually a relative that may have a substance abuse problem, would that be appropriate to – how would we handle that situation in trying to get that senior citizen to call you? Because it seems like there could be some other issues in this kind of a situation for that senior besides them just taking their car out while they're drinking.
And Susan, that's a good question, because usually one issue leads into multiple issues. And we get a lot of them like that, whether or not the caregiver family member has a substance abuse issue, or they are taking the elder's prescription drugs and using them themselves, especially if they have pain medications. Before you know it, there are medications missing, and they're going without. They're having to live in pain because of somebody else's addiction. So by us being called, sometimes that's just will initiate the investigation. If we're able to determine or suspect that this individual is stealing from them, of course we get law enforcement involved. A lot of times they don't know that their medications are being taken from them. So it might be a doctor that notifies us. It might be another family member, a good friend who suspects this is going on. So we have a lot of eyes and ears in the community, and that's how we find out lot of these would go unreported if it was, if it weren't for, you know, the folks we have in this community that, that are looking out for our elders or our dependent adults. So if we initiate or start the investigation, we find something is not right, we'll look into it or where we need to go to make the situation right. It may, and again, with all the different resources, it could be one other resource, it may be several resources that would be conferring with to take care of this situation. We may have to make a referral over to the public guardian's office to see about conservatorship if this individual is unable to care for themselves safely. So, Susan, did I answer that?
Yes, you did. Yeah. I'd like to know where all the resources are.
Well, we have a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think the hardest part is finding a place where we could start that piece, because making that referral for the elder person to, because they usually put so much trust in this caregiver, and then when they finally realize that.
They do, and a lot of times, Susan, they don't want to believe that they're being taken advantage of. And a lot of times, it's not the elder that's calling us. It's somebody else in the community that's calling, but that's how we get involved in those types of situations. But they're hurt. They're you know, they usually come from the day when a handshake was all it took, and here you get somebody just moved in and they have a substance abuse problem, which we see a lot of, and they're taking advantage of them. But most of the time they don't want to prosecute. Unlike domestic violence, where the DA's office can still initiate a filing, criminal filing on them, in elder abuse, it's not there yet. I'm hoping someday we'll see that, whether or not the elder wants to prosecute or not, that the state will take over and prosecute these individuals. Because a lot of them they'll do their deed in one county and they move on.
I just wanted to thank all of you. It was a very good presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
I had a question. I know that teachers are mandatory reporters, and I was wondering if in this county, very many people enter the system through that route.
Yes, we do get quite a few reports from teachers. I would say that's one of our primary areas of response. We have in the three main areas of the county, north, central, and south, we have what we call the SAFE system of care, which is a multidisciplinary team to review child abuse and actually juvenile probation cases on a voluntary basis. And anyone can bring those cases to the table. The family can voluntarily request it. Teachers can request it. Mental health therapists can request it. Public health, any agency at that multidisciplinary team can request that. So that has done a great deal in opening up the lines of communication, and I believe the trust between all of those different agencies, particularly the schools. So we do have quite a few schools that report on a regular basis, and we are always striving to improve our relationship with the schools by making responses at times that aren't disruptive to the children, but during times that we feel that we can get the most complete interview away from the parents, especially for a child in a very severe situation. But teachers do a very good job in this county. Just to give you one more statistic, we have a very active county that reports child abuse. Across the state, the average is 50 children per 1,000 receive a report of suspected child abuse or neglect. In our county, it's 70.5% per 1,000. So we have a lot of people who care very deeply about our children and who are paying very close attention to how they're being cared for in all walks of life and professional life.
So.
Are there any other questions from the commissioners? Members of the audience? Step up to the podium, please. Thanks.
Yes, I am Jesse Arnold. I want to thank Pam for organizing the panel, and thank you, Penny, for your role here. And thanks to all the members for your presentation, and I certainly want to thank you for the work you do. Not something I could do, so thank you very much. I've been, like David O'Dell, I've also been reading the paper and listening to the radio, and one of the things I'm hearing about is soldiers coming back from Iraq suffering from PTSD and getting involved in domestic violence. And the irony here, of course, is they've been pulled into state-sponsored violence, sent to Iraq. What they're doing there is abusive torture. So our country shouldn't be setting that kind of example. It filters down to the local level. But anyway, I did want to find out if you people keep any track of how much of this violence of any kind that you're seeing is in any way related to returning soldiers from Iraq or previous wars. Thank you.
I do know that it is domestic violence within the military community is a huge problem. Some areas of the armed forces are addressing it better than others. And we don't have a large population in this county, so I couldn't really give you any statistics. All I know is from the reading. I don't know if anyone else wants to chime in here, but just the conferences I've been to, I know it's a big problem. They are addressing it in your communities where you have large military bases, but I couldn't really speak to it specifically because we do not have a large, but possibly Benita can. She's raising her hand, so.
Chime in. There you go.
Hello again. The trauma recovery community is very concerned about this, and myself and a few other therapists in the area who have a lot of experience in working with post-traumatic stress disorder. I've been working I worked for years with returning Vietnam-era vets, mostly the nurses, the female and really undercover victims of the Vietnam War. And we've gotten together and we're having informal conversations right now about trying to set up some kind of a situation where there would be a clearinghouse where anybody who had a concern, either the vet or somebody who was experiencing violence from a vet or had a concern about a vet, could contact one of us. Because we do see that that is not yet a problem in our county, but it will be. That's a coming issue, so it's an important topic, and it would be very nice for once to be ahead of the curve.
Yeah, I had some concern around that also because of we do have a high number of Vietnam vets in the area, and they were talking about them being re-traumatized with this, mm-hmm. and I think it is something we have to be on the watch for.
That it? The questions? Again, thank you very much. I really appreciate the work you do and the time that you took out of your schedules and your lives to be here tonight and share the information with us. It's very much appreciated. And to the members of the viewing audience, if there's any message that you do take away from this, I would personally ask that you convey the message of help is out there. There are resources and help is there, and it is available and it does work. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to say thank you also, and on behalf of the entire commission. We really appreciate this. We've been trying to have more educational and informative meetings for the public. Hopefully they may not watch tonight, but they look through the television and they see a subject. And we hope to get some publicity about it. So thank you, Pam and Penny. Very much for setting this up, and thank you all for being here. And Dr. Thomas wants
yes,
to say something.
Perhaps it would be helpful just to find out what the number was, you know, on the resource card that's distributed for domestic violence, mm-hmm. intimate partner violence. There is a phone number that people can call, and maybe we ought to share that phone number tonight.
Yes, and I have these brochures. I'll leave them with you. Also, and it has our numbers in here, but our crisis number, the best way to get a hold of us and any resource really is called the 549-8989 number. It's the local hotline number, and they can get a hold of us 24 hours a day, you know, 365 days a year. If you have any volunteer interest or presentation interest, maybe you want us to come talk to your group, you can call our business line at 781-6410. And I'm sorry, 6401. I gave you my fax line. Don't call that. So if you have any other questions about anything else, you can call the business line. And I know these folks have numbers, too, if you'd like to give those.
Child Welfare Services is also available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Our hotline number is 781-5437. Otherwise known as 781-KIDS, which is a little easier to remember. But we are also available, and we can make cross reports as suitable, even in the middle of the night, if needed.
And with Adult Protective Services, our number is 781-1790, and there's always somebody there to take a referral from you. Or if you'd like one of us to come out and give a presentation to a group, please call us, and we'll be more than happy to do that.
Mm-hmm. Victim Witness is, we're 781-5821. We also have a toll-free number of 866-781-5821, but we always want to encourage people, if it's a severe crisis or an emergency, please dial 911.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And we do have we have a message line, so we return calls immediately.
And all of you are available via hotline, is
yes.
that correct?
Yes.
Off hours.
Yes.
So hotline, the 549-8989 is the number that you can call to reach any of these.
Isn't it now 211?
I was going to.
They're not completely
yet.
Up and running yet.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard you have to have a landline.
I was going to say, yes. Somebody pull out your cell phone.
I don't think so.
I heard not on the cell phone, but I thought I read that the 211 is active, isn't it?
Yeah, on landlines.
On landline.
Yeah.
But are you people, if they call 211, would they have you?
Well, if they call 211, they're going to reach the people who are hotline.
I know.
So, yeah, they would have our information.
That's what I mean, are you hooked in? So
absolutely.
They could give them your information. It's much simpler for somebody to call 211.
Yeah, we can't wait till 211 completes. Yeah, it will be great.
Just heard on the radio they were asking for volunteers for that, for the 211.
Yeah.
I see that Dr. Thomas is trying to get the brochure on the line.
And
actually, we're going to take a short break, so we may be able to get the logistics of this worked out so that we can have these numbers displayed in a few minutes for everyone.
Okay.
So thank you all very much. We are going to take a short break before we move on with our agenda.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, well, we will resume now our agenda and with our Public Health Department report from Dr. Thomas.
Good evening. First of all, I'd like to pass out a memo about the upcoming budget challenges from Jeff Hamm, Health Agency Director that went to staff. Kind of as a backdrop. First of all, there's a question last month about water hookups. Commissioner Chamoussis had a question about how many hookups it took to be a small water system. And I said that I thought it was 3 or more, and it's 5 to 100 to be a small water system. So if you have 3 or 4 homes hooked up to a water system, then it is a private, fully private water system. So then you do your own testing and are responsible for your own safety.
That.
Sure. Secondly, we'll be coming to the board shortly with the syringe exchange program update. For the first year, around 5,700 syringes were accepted in exchange, and 4,600 were given out. It's too early to say that this is the cause, but I'm very glad to say that this year to date, we have about 60 cases of hepatitis C reported. That's acute and chronic, so they're not all acute. Last year it was about 160, so we've seen a pretty significant decrease in our hep C reports so far. As I say, it's really premature to say that this trend will continue or that how much of it is due to the syringe exchange program. And our HIV reporting, because of changes in the way that is reported, is basically changing. It used to be a unique identifying code, and now it's based on HIV names reporting. So that's changed the baseline. I'm happy to say that our health education specialist working on obesity prevention starts December 3rd, finally. And I can remember her first name. It's Angel. And I can't remember her last name right now. So, but she is starting December 3rd. The Obesity Prevention Task Force Subcommittee on Physical Activity and Nutrition and Heal Slow are going to get together. Heal Slow stands for Healthy Eating and Active Living. It's been a collaboration that's been working for the last couple of years. And I'm excited that they're getting closer and probably going to join forces. There's a meeting to discuss that. The website on obesity prevention at the health department is, well, we're going to host it initially at the health department. It's closer to going live. And I'd like to report about the Children's Health Initiative and Public Health and CHC got together with the Rio Grande Hospital and had a dental health fair within the last couple of weeks and provided dental education and fluoride varnish to I think a couple of hundred kids, and so it was a real success. You probably have heard that I am moving to a new position at Cal Poly Health Center. I'm excited by the opportunity to go back to taking care of patients and try and use that healer touch that hopefully I had when I was doing as much medical care as when I started my health officer job. I thought I'd talk about, I just wanted to give you my wish list of 7 things that I would like to see, and maybe they're overly hopeful, but I'm going to finish by giving a short update on the budget status, and that is somewhat sobering, but in the meantime, hope springs eternal, and the long view is really what makes a difference. So my wish list. For a long time, number one is putting more effort and funding into primary prevention, prevention of a lot of the chronic diseases, obesity prevention. Number two is a realization that economics, minimum wage, is highly associated with health status, that if our minimum wage is so low that it won't pay for basic food and shelter, then you're going to have homelessness, desperation, malnutrition, disease, and that if you have to have all 4 members of the family working, including the children, at younger ages than they should be working, that affects the fabric of the family. As we've heard today, it really does take a village to raise a family, and we have many wonderful things about this county, but the cost of housing is not one of those wonderful things. Next is fluoridation of the water systems. That's been a topic for the Health Commission over the years, and not a insurmountable task. It is a task. The majority of bankruptcies are due to large medical debt from inadequate health insurance. So universal health insurance would be the next. Sue Warren will be glad to see that the next one is an outpatient detox program. Next would be, you've heard about the medically fragile homelessness situation and putting together a program for the medically fragile homeless. And then, Jesse, I have not forgotten the labeling of GMO foods. That fits on the list as well. So I thought it was appropriate to give you a wish list. I don't know whether I'll be here next month at the Health Commission, but this seemed, well, maybe that's my Christmas wish list. Maybe I'll bring it back next month anyway.
Are you retiring?
No, I'm going to work full-time at the Cal Poly Student Health Center.
Are you retiring from the county?
Yes. Well, I'll contract back to retiring sounds like I'm not going to another job. I'm going to another full-time job, and I'm expecting to contract back to provide backup health officer after hours occasionally and some of the disaster response.
So when is this going to occur?
My last day is officially looks like it'll be January 11th.
Oh, really?
Yes, so January 31st I start the new position.
Are they recruiting then for a health officer?
Yes. Yes. Right now we are discussing an interim position with a health officer who is going to be retiring in January from another county and has always wanted to move to either Cambria or Shell Beach. And so he's interested in a perhaps 3-month interim position. So hopefully we'll have excellent interim coverage while they do a larger recruitment.
Well, we're sure going to miss you.
God, thank you.
I really have enjoyed working with you so much. And
thank you. It's been a lot of wonderful, wonderful things. I really believe in public health and that population-based approach to improving health in the community. I need to go back to taking care of individual patients for a while. And get out of the administrative and financial end of this business for a while. Okay, I'd like to go to this brief presentation of some of the issues. This is actually the PowerPoint that was presented by David Edge at the budget workshop for the Board of Supervisors. And so, you know, the national outlook, as you're very aware of, the housing crisis in terms of the downturn in sales and the extent to which our economy is dependent on property tax values increasing to make up for the cost of living increases and other support areas that we have to pay for, as well as a federal budget deficit and the cost of supporting wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Some of the same issues: slow housing market, steady local economy, but trickle-down impacts from state and federal funded programs and some decreases in local consumer spending, sales tax revenue going down, or at least not keeping pace with other increased costs. As the pension rate increase of 9.75%, you probably saw in the paper in the last day or two, they're going to be looking closely. Why did this come as such a surprise? OPEB is the retired pension costs. We'll show you a graph of some of the health agency cost increases, the COLA increase, and inflationary costs. This is for the overall budget. Expense assumptions of total expenditures for the county of $399 million, with increases of 5.34% of prevailing wage, and there's a lot of questions about why in this era of decreasing funding would we be increasing our salaries by 5.34. And there was an ordinance that was passed by the voters a number of years ago that mandates that the wages paid to county employees be based on comparison to the other comparison counties, so that we don't fall behind on what we pay here. It is a tough year to be giving increases. And then you add the 1% to trying to catch up the inequities, and then the final pension increase this year of 3.25, and you see a pretty significant 8.2% increase in salaries and benefits. A contingency of 5% and a 3% CPI. This gives you a gap, as you can see down here on the bottom, of $20 million when you include the fund balance available and a 5% contingency. So why is that hitting us in particular? Partly because where does the money go? 33% of all the money brought in goes to Health and Human Services. 58% of all the county budget goes to salary and benefits, 36% to service and supplies, 30% to services and supplies. This is not CIP. I wasn't planning to give you that. This is a graph which is pretty hard to read, but it shows the difference between total expenditures since 1999 and the total revenue. And it's been pretty close, and you see a widening over the past few years. And so this is projected between revenue and expenditures, with the expenditures being here and the revenue being here. Our net county cost has gone up, thankfully, because it's prevented pretty severe cuts in some of the programs. Net county cost was 5% of our overall budget about 7 or 8 years ago, and it is now 25%. So you can see that it's gone from 7.3% in 99 to 18.8% for public health alone. And the net county cost has gone from $2.17 million to $11.85 million. Or, as David Edge likes to point out, that's a 441% increase. Now, what does that lead for the health agency? A similar 5.5% wage increase and a 2.2% pension liability, a 4.5% inflationary factor, no increase in fixed assets, some interfund transfers, and an increase in revenue of 4%. That gives you a net county cost increase of $3.2 million if we were to continue status quo. If we continue doing exactly what we do now, then it would be a $3.2 million increase in the general fund. Now, what are our options? Increase our revenues. We have limited ability to do that. Fee hearing is tomorrow, and to the extent that we've been able to, we are increasing some fees in environmental health. 98%, 99% of our public health department immunization services and other clinical services are to Medi-Cal patients or state-only family planning patients. And so if 99% of your patients are from those categories, you can raise your fees all you want, and it doesn't really do you any good because Medi-Cal pays what they're going to pay. This is, again, 75% is of the health agency as a whole is funded by revenue, and the balance, $19.3 million general fund contribution. Some of it is so-called hard match to meet maintenance of effort. However, that is only $3 million of the $19.3 million. Another $6 million leverage the state funds. So we are, as Jeff Hamm was here 2 or 3 months ago, we had put forward some at-risk programs. There's some things that the county board members can do that will make county administrative office and everybody in the county somewhat nervous. They can cut the general fund contingencies from 5% to whatever they think they can get away with. Every percentage is $4 million. So if they cut the general fund contingency from 5% to 3%, then the gap is for the whole county is now $12 million. That would help somewhat. I don't know that they're willing to cut it any further than that, and we'll have to see what they do. In the meantime, we will be putting together a budget in the health agency that is a status quo budget, and then we have a new form that's called a BRRRF. It's called a budget reduction form. And last year we were filling out budget augmentation request forms, or BARs, and this year we're BRRRFing. And we will very carefully point out some of the impacts to some of those reductions in services. Obviously, the cuts come in the discretionary programs over the mandatory programs. So, and some of those are painful things to consider. I'm glad I'm not a Board of Supervisor member because it's going to be a tough budget year. So that's really, hate to finish the note on such a cautionary note, I think there will be more details forthcoming. There is a hiring process in place right now. On October 30th, the Board of Supervisors put in place something they called the hiring process. And the hiring process is kind of like a freeze, but a freeze with a exemption request process that goes to Mr. Edge. I think the difference this time is that we're not just asked, do you really need this position? But if we fill this position, or is this position at risk in the next budget year? So let's say it's an administrative assistant. Of all the administrative assistants and for all the programs you have, are any of them going to be potentially cut next year? And if the answer is yes, then there will be discussion about why you have to fill that one as opposed to fill it now and lay somebody off, because the most recent hired is the first one to be laid off. That freeze does not affect temp help right now. It's less to save. The idea is to save some money this fiscal year, but really to avoid layoffs next fiscal year if they come to pass. That's it. Any questions for me?
Are there any questions for Dr. Thomas from commissioners? Commissioner Hetherington? I guess you're happy getting out of here before all of this happens, huh? I want to thank you, Dr. Thomas. I've been on the commission longer than anybody, and it reaffirms how great you are by the wish list you leave behind. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And I got to say, it's been a pleasure to work with all of the members of the Health Commission over the last several years. You're a great voice for public education, and you have communication that goes forward to the health agency as a whole and to the board members as well.
Mr. O'Dell?
Yeah, we'd just like to add that I worked with a lot of public health officers in my career in San Diego, Alameda, Orange County, L.A., and you are the finest public health officer I've ever worked with.
I will not not forget that praise. Thank you very much. Very, very much.
Unfortunately, all of this praise won't convince you to to become a real doctor again.
Hmm? I'm looking forward to becoming a real doctor again.
You'd be a well, I think we all wish you well, and we are sad to lose you, but we can understand how exciting this is for you. So thank you for your many years of service. Okay, so we'll, as usual, move on to the next item on the agenda, which is our Health Commission updates. Chair update. I attended shortly after the last meeting. I attended an obesity prevention workshop that was held at Kennedy Fitness, and it was sponsored by Kennedy Fitness and Sierra Vista Hospital and supported by the Obesity Task Force, and it was excellent. They were able to film it, and hopefully we will be able to have it shown on public television or at least on the county channels. And the Obesity Task Force is accumulating video clips that they can use to inform people, to inform the public of what they need to be considering to in this obesity prevention climate that we're now experiencing. I think that it's the many articles that we see on the in the paper and in magazines and on television point out how aware the media is and the public is becoming of this prevention that is hopefully we're going to find some answers. Then the other thing that I did attend was the SART meeting just this past week. SART has moved into their new premises. It is the old General Hospital emergency room. And there are a number of things that SART needs, and very importantly, I would like to ask anybody who's listening who is interested in forensic nursing to please contact Deborah Farwell at SART, because nurse examiners and nurse assistants are desperately needed. This is a very tough job. It's a job that people do not because they like doing the work, but because they feel that it's important and they want to contribute, much like serving on domestic violence task force. So this is simply a plea to anybody out there who might be interested. The child interviewing room is still looking for some comfortable furniture, a couch and a couple of chairs. Possibly they have found them by now, but if anyone out there has furniture they would be willing to donate to Kate, that would be very nice. And we're working on, they are working on volunteers to do translation when they are interviewing victims. And that program is going forward and is really kind of cutting edge. I don't think other counties have this, that we will have bilingual translators, and they have to be very literal bilingual. I mean, it can't be just sort of translating. And so that should be getting going, I think, fairly soon in the next few months. And, of course, our dear Dr. Thomas has been the medical examiner Forsart, and he will be leaving that position as well. And Dr. Nisha Abdul-Qadr will be taking over. She has been associated with SART for a number of years and is a very kind and therapeutic examiner. I guess that's the best way to describe that. And so that is the end of my report. And I will now move to the left, my left, and ask each commissioner if they have anything to report. And I think Commissioner Tilscher already told me he did not have something to report.
Nothing to report.
How about Commissioner Garena?
Nothing to report.
And Commissioner Hetherington?
Well, I attended the victim witness open house. It was standing room only. It was a great tribute to the great people that do all of these things in these horrific circumstances. I also attended the Domestic Violence Task Force, and I'm going to let it go at that.
Shemosis?
I will be reporting on both the November and December Adult Services Policy Commission meetings in December.
Commissioner Horn?
No report.
Commissioner O'Dell?
On the Mental Health Board has the same news, of course, which Dr. Thomas just outlined, as far as this will be a very tough time, and particularly in areas that may get into actual direct therapy of cuts. That's the sad news.
Commissioner Warren.
Yes, I attended the Drug and Alcohol Services annual retreat, and they're doing a little restructuring, and it was an exciting evening, and when they came up with a lot of different ideas that I'll report on their final decisions at the next meeting.
All right, now we'll move on to the committee reports, and the legislative committee did meet. Commissioner Shemosis, would you like to report?
I'd love to report. Jeff Hamm has been attending our meetings. I was there along with Commissioner Enns, and Commissioner Warren also attended. We are just in the midst of discussing the development of the legislative platform, which is a package that sort of delineates the legislative issues that are being brought forth to the County Board of Supervisors for support. And it's a process that my primary interest as the chair of the legislative committee was to understand that process and how the Health Commission can be involved in it and how we as commissioners can provide input to that. I do have a copy of last year's legislative platform if the commissioners are interested in seeing that. And what we also did as a committee is put forth our own interests and what we felt would be most appropriate and prioritization-wise most important community health issues. And I would invite the other two commissioners to help if I miss anything, but I'm going off the minutes. The three issues that we were discussed was to support legislation that would increase state funding to counties for programs to address obesity prevention, and to support legislation that would require health insurance providers to include alcohol and substance addiction treatment as covered benefits. The other issue that we discussed was requiring labeling of genetically engineered foods. It was a very interesting discussion. The gist of which is there's two processes by which the commission can get legislative concerns to the Board of Supervisors and or our legislative representatives. One is via Jeff in terms of incorporating it into the legislative platform. The other is if it was an issue that Jeff Hamm did not feel was viable via that avenue to propose language on our own to get that legislative or political issue to the Board of Supervisors or to our legislative representatives to address. And the genetically engineered food labeling fell into that latter category, i.e., Mr. Hamm did not feel that that was a viable legislative platform at this time. I did have a subsequent follow-up telephone call with him and did ask him to do some personal research into that issue to help me understand the whys behind that and the avenues that we could take if that was of interest and supported by the members of this health commission. It seems to be very timely since it was addressed several times tonight, and it is also on your wish list, and thank you very much for that. I truly, that was pretty brave. It does not look like, from the point of view of legislative action, it is particularly viable in that the question is, what would need to be changed in order for that to become law, let's say, let's just put it in a simple term. What aspect of current ordinance, statute, laws, whatever, would need to be changed in order to affect genetically engineered food labeling as a state? I mean, it's certainly not a countywide issue that we could propose via the legislative committee, but as a, on the state level. The answer that I got back from Jeff was essentially that should we propose this legislation, it would override federal mandates. And that is not possible through that venue. Personally, I think it's a very important issue. I hear from other people, both from the commission and from the public, that it continues to be a very important issue. At this point in time, I'm open to any and all suggestions in terms of an approach that should we that's potentially viable. How do we get this to our legislators to some point that we could take an action on it? I don't know at this point in time. So I guess I raised another agenda item. Sorry.
There appears to be some questions or some statements that want to, in regard to this, Commissioner Hetherington and then Commissioner Horn.
I guess before I would say that we would drop it, that that maybe what we should do is some due diligence in the state of California to see if there's any other counties that have health commissions that are interested in this and see if maybe we can't start a little rumble ourselves. I think, you know, it's always good to have partners in things like this. At one point, it was a viable option to have it in the state, you know. I don't know where that legislation went, but I for one wouldn't want to drop it, if, even if he said he wasn't comfortable recommending it.
Having served on the task force for genetically modified crops, my feeling is that we do need to drop it, that this is, unless the state in some way can effectively get the federal government to move in requiring that these crops be marketed under their being genetically modified, you're going to just be kind of going through this motion and you'll never get anywhere. And the question is it worth putting all that effort to go nowhere? Because it is a federal, it's a federal responsibility. It is not a state responsibility. The fact that we have one person who is willing to put out that he has genetically modified corn, I think is great. And if other people want to do it on a volunteer, that's great. But to mandate it, you've got to come through the feds.
Well, I hope we don't drop it and have future discussions, because at least I think we could do is to act, this group, and encourage people to, in this county, like this one group did, by individual encouragement. This one individual did do that. And I would think if we did, and if the Board of Supervisors adopted to encourage people to do that in this county, that would at least be something. And something we could do.
This, maybe we should look at a different approach. This is very much like the trans fat issue. The trans fat issue, you know, came, I wanted to push on it. It turns out that the County of Los Angeles tried to push on it, and they discovered that the state is the only one who can deal in trans fats. But what's happening in Los Angeles now is that there are organizations that are pushing and restaurants that are showing signs that we are a trans fat free restaurant. And why, and maybe we should be looking at, instead of restricting GMOs, which is going to be difficult because of federal guidelines, maybe we should encourage and maybe start a program of, we do not serve genetically modified crops in our restaurant. We do not sell them in our grocery, and we're proud of it, and we then people will ask, well, why don't you have that sign?
I think that's a wonderful idea, and I would love to see something like that happen. I think a grassroots movement is probably the best way at this point in time. The issue is, without labeling, we don't know what we're serving. We don't know what we're eating. We don't know if that can of tomatoes is genetically modified or not, because it's not labeled.
I have a comment. I think that when you're talking about food that comes from somewhere outside our state, you don't really have any control over that. And so until you have some sort of action at the federal level, you're not going to be able to absolutely determine what is in food that is distributed throughout the country. However, the local example has been set. And so I think that when you ask people to do something voluntarily, you get a better response. And so rather than it being a legislative issue, it seems like it might be more of an issue, I think like David mentioned, that an issue that is where we're asking just in our county, at our farmers markets, that sort of thing, if you are able to state whether your products. And I think corn is about the only thing that we have a concern about here that's grown and sold here. So we're not talking about a wide variety. However, your corn chips that you buy, there's no, you know, but, you know, there may be worse stuff in them than genetically modified. So there we are. I think we need to move it from the legislative into more of a community encouragement type of issue. And let's see. I think Commissioner Horn has a comment. Commissioner Hetherington has a comment. And did you have another comment, Commissioner Green? Okay. And we'll just go ahead with this. And I just know that Jesse's dying to say something as well. So we'll go ahead, and we have a little time.
To me.
So Commissioner Horn, Commissioner Hetherington, and then Mr. Arnold.
Yes, I do want to say to the public out there, anybody who has any concerns about genetically modified always has the option of going with organic, which is not genetically modified and which supposedly will not become genetically modified. And so that there is a viable opportunity for people to make sure that they're not getting genetically modified crops.
You're not only getting non-genetically modified crops, you're not getting crops grown in sewage sludge or irradiated. So going organic, I think, is probably your safest bet. And by looking at the growth of the industry, we know that people are asking for clean food. But I'm not ready to let it die yet.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Enns. My name is Jesse Arnold. I've known all along that the federal government has preempted labeling. That's known, and I'm not claiming anything differently. But it's a question of deciding to be a leader. Federal laws get changed. All politics is local. Federal laws get changed because people at the local level said, we want the federal law to change. So I'm simply asking this group, are you going to take a stand and say that you're in favor of changing the law? And it's not real complicated. Dennis Kucinich has introduced a bill on this. I'm sorry I don't have it with me, but I think the legislative committee, that's their job to look at bills. And then you can ask this group, do they want to support Dennis Kucinich's bill? And I think David is exactly right. You could ask the supervisors to support local labeling. And as Sarah's pointed out, we have a very good example here. Just ask them to support local voluntary labeling. Great. And Sarah made a good point. And Pam, we have organic as a choice. And just to continue to educate people that they have that choice. But I would like to see this group take a stand and say, we will support Dennis Kucinich's bill after we've looked it over and seen if we can support that, or at least that you support in principle labeling. And if you can get behind Dennis Kucinich's bill, all the better. Thanks.
Hey, I think we've exhausted the legislative committee report. How about community education?
She's exhausted.
Now, maybe that's a subject community education would like to take up rather than the legislative committee. Budget committee?
Budget committee has no report.
And the nominating chair is not here. And did not submit a report, so I assume there's nothing to be said there. Okay, so our next meeting is in December, and we have our traditional meeting of December being those organizations that provide community services, specifically in the health field, come and talk to us about their programs and their needs for the coming year. And the way the budgets are going, everybody's going to have needs in the coming year. So that's what we'll be doing next month. So I hope Dr. Thomas will come one more time for Auld Lang Syne.
We'll bring cookies.
And
punch.
Free cookies. And we can, wish everybody Merry Christmas at that time. If there is nothing else from other commissioners, then I would say that a motion to adjourn would be entertained. There being no objections, this meeting is now adjourned. Thank you all very much.